well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. We are a little concerned about that free state right now, aren't we? We've seen a run on ammunition and firearms around the country over the weekend. Lines out the door in gun stores in Southern California. Here locally in Farmville, Virginia, I talked with a friend of mine who owns the local gun store. He said that there's been a surge in ammo purchases, particularly 9mm, 223, 5.56. But what I've heard and what I've been told is that there's no issue in the supply chain. There are some allocations that are going on in terms of common calibers, but ammunition continues to be produced. There is no sourcing issue in terms of lead or things of that nature. We've got all the components that we need to manufacture this. The one thing that I have heard is that if there are labor issues, if for some reason, you know, factories have to close, not for some reason, I think we would know what the reason is. If those factories have to close, then you might see, supply chain issues. But that has not happened. And given the economic crisis that we are in, right along with the coronavirus crisis, I do expect that there's going to be every effort given to keep these factories running, not just ammunition factories, but every manufacturing center running at some capacity while we go through the next couple of months. One of the other issues that I wanted to talk about here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company, but it won't be today. It'll likely be tomorrow. The number of orders that we're now seeing that, close down businesses, can shutter, bars, restaurants, movie theaters. We've also seen, though, a couple of emergency declarations that supposedly empower mayors to restrict the transportation of firearms. That was in a order that was signed in New Orleans. Champaign, Illinois, mayor there signing a declaration that gives her the authority, supposedly, to ban the transfer of firearms or ammunition. And so I do want to talk with an attorney about the legality of a lot of these, a lot of the language in these emergency declarations. I happen to think that a lot of those are challengeable, but we're now seeing court systems operate on an emergency basis. So what are the prospects of actually getting an answer to some of these questions? We will be dealing with that in the days ahead. But on today's program, we're going to talk with James Eric Dietz. He's the director of the Homeland Security Institute at Purdue University. Twofold topic of conversation here. First, we're going to talk about the pandemic. He has done some research into pandemics. We're going to talk about flattening that curve and the trade-off between the economic pain that we're experiencing right now and are going to be experiencing in the weeks ahead versus the ability, hopefully, to flatten this curve, to keep our healthcare systems from being overwhelmed, which would make things much worse. So we'll talk again with the Dr. Dietz coming up here in just a matter of moments. And then you're going to hear from Jason Rantz with KTTH Radio up in Seattle. One of the things that I've noticed over the weekend, there's been a lot of second and third hand reporting. You'll see on social media somebody say, hey, I just heard from a doctor who says he works here, and this is what they're saying. All right, well, Jason actually lives in Seattle. Jason has been covering what is happening in Seattle, including talking to folks at hospitals. So I think you're going to get a firsthand report at what life is actually like now in a city where we've had a cluster of these cases at a nursing home. And again, the hospitals are starting to deal with this in Seattle, maybe a little bit more than they are where you live right now. Doesn't mean that we won't be nationwide or you won't be locally where Seattle is in a week or two. Hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully, again, we can flatten this curve and we can get ahead of the spread of this virus. But you're going to hear from Jason Rantz coming up in just a little bit as well. But right now, let's kick things off with our conversation with Dr. James Eric Dietz, the director of Homeland Security's Institute, or the Homeland Security Institute, rather, at Purdue University. Take a look and a listen. Eric, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. It's a real pleasure to get a chance to talk with you again.
Of course, happy to do so.
And we're going to talk about magazine capacity, the research that you're doing, because I think it applies to this new lawsuit that we've seen in Connecticut. But as the director of the Homeland Security Institute, I imagine that your work involves more than just Second Amendment issues. Have you done any research or have you worked on you know, anything that might be applicable to the situation that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah, actually, Cam, we did a lot of work looking at pandemic flu and flu preparedness. And we did this really with the last major flu outbreak. We did a lot of work for the state, over 100 exercises, looking at readiness at the county level, at the hospital level, and at the state level. And one of the underlying themes that we found with that was just the sheer overwhelming nature of these events. That's what we're seeing in the news today.
Mm-hmm.
We also saw the really the one significant thing that every single individual can do is just do a great job washing your hands. Really wash the fingertips, wash between the fingers, take your time doing so, and dry your hands properly, and then stay away from others when you're sick. That social distancing is something that we're seeing, sadly, far too little of right now. We've seen lots of reports, even in the current event, that people, even with in my community, we got people that are worried about their ice cream businesses and their cupcake businesses more so than we're worrying about the flu and the health of our community. I mean, we really need to social distance, stay away from one another when we're sick or when we think we're sick, and also just kind of keep those distances to make us a harder target for spreading the flu.
Yeah.
Those two things can make a dramatic change. Our research showed using 1918 levels of disease spread that we could reduce the peak from being about a third of the population to being about 9% of the population. And we could change the peak from being, you know, a couple weeks into the event, kind of like what we're seeing now,
mm-hmm.
To many weeks into the event, you know, a dozen or more weeks. Those two things alone allow us to really change what we were looking at the time, some of the personnel things that we were worried about, like how do we manage hospitals and first responder tasks with a third of the population or a third of those people that are out absent and sick. And so we basically tried to redefine the problem. Said, well, if we really do a good job hand washing and really do a good job sending people home when we're sick, we can treat it more to like normal summer vacation, which is, you know, 10% or so of the folks are gone at any given time. And, you know, I think a lot of this is just we need to kind of recalibrate our set points. Instead of that coworker that comes in when they're sick to help you get a job done that, you know, do that week, and you kind of punch them in the arms, say, yeah, I can appreciate you coming in, and I know it was, you know, a tough week for you. Instead, we need to take one look at them and send them home. Say, wash your hands and get the heck out of here.
Absolutely.
And then, the other thing that I think that we all sometimes forget, especially around our office spaces, is how important it is to wipe down those fomites, those inanimate objects that help us spread disease. You might call them the copier button or the light switch or the stapler. those things that we rarely wipe down, mm-hmm. the coffee pot handle, for crying out loud, those things that we rarely wipe down, but we almost all touch over the course of the day, really have a huge impact on the spread of disease. And so, you know, a good office routine, a couple of good kind of personal hygiene routines about staying away from others when we're sick. You know, if we're ill, stay at home and stay away from our families. You know, get in a different room, you know, try to at least, you know, maintain some distance. Those things are all vital and important and essential, really, to try to make sure that we minimize the impact of a terrible event like we're staring at right now.
Absolutely. And you know, you talk about those small business owners. I've got friends who are plumbers. They own restaurants. They are, and they're terrified, you know, about what the next couple of months mean for them. But at the same time, if we don't take those steps now that you're talking about, we're looking at an even longer period where things are going to be closed. We're looking at more closures than what we're looking at now. And it's, you know, it's this incredible balance. I mean, we live in a day and age, Dr. Dietz, where, you know, we're so polarized and we're so divided. And if, you know, one side says red, the other side says green. And so there's, you know, I understand the difficulty that all of these elected officials are in right now. On the one hand, again, you're trying to prevent the hospital systems from being overwhelmed, as we've seen in Italy. That won't just impact those COVID-19 patients, but that will impact everybody who needs critical care in a hospital setting if those beds get overwhelmed. So I understand the desire to flatten the curve, I guess is the phrase. And that right. absolutely right. is critical. At the same time, we are dealing with, you know, this economic shock to the system, and that is going to have some pain as well. And I know that, you know, do you think that at some point, is this a balancing act for, you know, those officials who are directing the response right now, where they're weighing the damage to the economy versus the potential loss of life? And is that something that is constantly recalibrated as this disease progresses?
Yeah, I think I think to some degree you're right. I think some of the, you know, the politicians are weighing which is going to be worse. I think we need to kind of reinforce to everyone, the politicians and the public, that this is a very serious event. We don't know how bad it's going to be. We have some ideas by looking at China and Italy, for instance. And we also know that if we don't take, you know, really dramatic action, we're going to overwhelm the hospitals, because that happened in both the other countries. And so no matter what the economic impact is right now, because frankly, there's a restaurant in my community that is a nice sit-down Italian restaurant that decided that they were going to basically open, but only for carry out and delivery. And if you ordered a day ahead of time, they would even make dinner for four, however, with any other specifications you might need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I suspect they're going to have their business overrun, because we still have some money and we're still going to want some creature comforts, and we're still going to want to have, you know, comfort food and things that make us feel like, you know, we've got to go out to dinner. But if you got to stay in your house for a couple of weeks, which is kind of what we're suggesting, or what the experts are suggesting here, you know, that's one of those kinds of things that is going to help a business thrive and survive. And when my wife told me this, my prediction was there'll be a lot of businesses that are trying to figure out how to quickly emulate that. I think we need to do that across the country a lot more. We've got a lot of the young that feel bulletproof with this, and so far the symptoms seem to indicate that they have much less symptoms, but that doesn't mean they're not carriers. They're not bringing it back to their parents or their grandparents that they're, you know, visiting them, or spreading things about. And certainly when they have a bad downturn, who's going to take care of the, you know, the 20 somethings that are enjoying themselves right now? I think we just all need to kind of pitch in and realize, this is they've defined it a pandemic for a reason. It is a global event, and these global events, we're going to have dramatic global shortages of things like masks and gloves and ventilators and other things that we would normally find, you know, in adequate supply, so that we don't worry about shortages. People are going to be sacrificed if we aren't all kicking in and doing our part, you know, trying to stay a little bit more healthy and a little bit more wise with our actions in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. Talking again with Dr. James Eric Dietz, the director of the Homeland Security Institute at Purdue University. And let's turn our attention, if we can, for just a moment, Dr. Dietz, to the research that you've been doing into magazine capacity and the benefits of larger magazine capacity. As I mentioned, we've seen a lawsuit filed in Connecticut over that state's, so they've got a ban on the new sale of magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds. But those existing owners, when this law went into effect back in 2013, were told, okay, you can keep your magazines, but you have to let the state police know that you have them. And then let's say you've got a 20-round magazine or a 17-round magazine, you can only have 10 rounds of ammunition in that magazine, or else you're breaking the law. So now you've got a couple of legal gun owners in Connecticut who are suing the state, saying that basically their right to keep and bear arms is being infringed, and that their right of self-defense is suffering. The state's argument is that, look, these magazine bans save lives, that criminals or active assailants would be forced to change their magazines sooner, and therefore, let's say you've got a tragedy like at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, which prompted this law. If the killer is using a 10-round magazine, they're going to have to swap out those magazines more frequently. That will reduce the lethality of the attack and allow for a greater response. Based on the modeling that you've done, what do you think about that argument? And what do you think about the argument from the legal gun owners in Connecticut who say, listen, the criminals aren't going to obey this law. It's going to be us, the folks who want to have a firearm for self-defense, who are going to be who are being hurt by this law.
Yeah, we look specifically at that kind of homeowner, the scenario from the homeowner's point of view. We looked at an armed intrusion scenario of a typical ranch home that many of us would live in, and looked at magazine capacity on the impact and how it would impact two armed intruders coming into the home. We found examples of those scenarios, multiples of that scenario, and used data from that scenario to basically go back in the model, and I'll have the gun owners, have the homeowners vary magazine capacity. And we did that from 7 rounds all the way up to 30 rounds in the magazine. And the most significant finding is going from 7 rounds to 30 rounds, that we doubled 2 times the survivability of the homeowner in an armed intrusion event. And so the idea that there's no, that it saved loss of life, that could be true for an active shooter kind of event. We currently are looking at that and looking at if you really are intending to do harm with a weapon, does magazine capacity really matter? Because mm-hmm. you're probably going to have a lot more magazines. You're going to reload a lot more often. We looked at it with our modeling, looked at the typical homeowner who might not be able to get to the range and train every month or even very often. And one of the things that we, looked at was, perhaps the, lack of a quick magazine change, that some of us that, don't get enough practice and enough hands-on practice with our guns. And so those issues all weighed into the more magazine capacity equaled more firepower, which, actually saved the day for half the homeowners or twice as many homeowners when that was increased. So that idea that magazine capacity does not favor the homeowner that's going through an intrusion scenario, because all too many times we talk about people that are already breaking the law by breaking in my house with a handgun are probably not going to abide by a 10-round mag limit or anything else. I think that the idea that we've got a bunch of legal gun owners having further constraints on their ability to help protect themselves is not really protecting any of us.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Dr. Dietz, I appreciate your time today, sir. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we can touch base again very soon. Be safe, sir. All right, so we're going to check in again with Dr. Dietz, I think, over the next couple of weeks or so, just to continue to get his perspective and what his research has shown. But again, I don't want to just talk to academics. I want to talk to as broad a cross-section of folks as we can. KTTH Radio's Jason Rance up in Seattle joined us for a couple of minutes as well to talk about what the situation is like on the ground there. Jason, thanks so much for coming on the show, sir. It's good talking with you today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think has been sort of adding to the fear and the uncertainty right now is it's so hard to get a handle on where we are at this moment. And I know up in Seattle, you all have had that cluster of COVID-19 cases at a nursing home. There were some, unconfirmed reports over this past weekend of hospitals being overwhelmed. We saw guidance from doctors saying, look, we're not overwhelmed yet, but we're concerned that we could get there. How would you describe life in Seattle today?
it is dramatically different than life in Seattle a month ago and even a day ago. On the way into work this morning, even during the coronavirus sort of scare, the outbreak, there's still been cars on the roads. There's still been some people on buses. There's virtually no cars. There's virtually no pedestrians or bicyclists. The buses are completely empty. And people are taking the advice, it seems, at least as of right now, that the governor and some of the other local leaders have given as of last night, which is hunker down if you can, self-quarantine if you can. If you have to go to work, but make sure you're taking as many precautions as possible. Now, part of the industries that are here in Seattle, they have very good technology, so a lot of people are telecommuting. All the schools are closed down, so even if some folks could have gone to work today, my sense is they're probably, at least in the next couple days, still trying to figure out what their childcare situation is going to be. So that's going to take some people off the roads. Obviously, that is an inconvenience. Obviously, there are some implications as far as personal economics goes, but overall, it's a positive because we want to help sort of stop the spread of this virus, to your point, so it doesn't actually overwhelm the hospital.
Yeah, and I've had some conversations with folks that, obviously it is impossible to ignore the economic impact that this is having. And at some point down the road, you may see the metric change, right? And hopefully we are able to prevent the system from being overwhelmed. But, I could see 2-3 weeks from now an argument being made of, okay, we tried it and, that didn't work. Now the economy is suffering. We gotta do something else. It's so hard to predict 24 hours into the future right now, much less, 2 or 3 weeks. But I know that, all around the country, Seattle, no exception, there are a lot of those folks who are more worried right now about what this is going to mean for their ability to pay rent and pay bills than they're worried about their health or their safety. And I understand that. That's the thing. I absolutely understand where those people are coming from. This is a situation unlike any that we have faced certainly in our lifetimes and maybe, going back 100 years or more. So there is that fear and that uncertainty. One of the things that we've seen, Jason, around the country is folks buying firearms and ammunition. Lines outside the door in California. My local gun store owner says that, they're selling out a 9mm, 223 almost as quickly as they can put it out on the shelf. What are you hearing up in the Seattle area in terms of are people not just going out and buying toilet paper, but are they buying ammunition too?
So they're definitely buying ammunition. One of the major sellers of ammo, Cabela's in Tulalip, some folks sent me photos over the weekend showing essentially a run on ammunition. We haven't seen that many stories coming out of gun shops yet. Part of the reason is we closed down a lot of the gun shops. There are none in the Seattle area now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's none in Seattle. So, we're still getting some of that word. My sense is you're going to start to see that in the coming days if it didn't already happen over the weekend. But just looking at the situation in Tulalip, which is about 45 minutes north of Seattle, my guess is you're going to start to see that already happen.
Okay. Well, listen, I do appreciate you calling in and just letting folks know what's going on there in Seattle. What is the latest that you're hearing? And I realize, again, this information could change an hour from now. But what is the latest that you're hearing? And what's the latest that healthcare professionals are saying about the hospital system there in Seattle?
I mean, what you said is about what we're hearing. So on the one hand, I'm assuming that you'll be able to find at short periods of time some hospitals overwhelmed. But overall, they've got a handle on this. Part of the reason why we're doing this hunkering down is because they want to continue to stay ahead of this.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people get sick and then go into the emergency room, which is, by the way, is not what you're supposed to do unless it's an emergency. You are going to overwhelm these hospitals and they're not going to be able to take care of you. So, again, listen to the healthcare professionals. If you happen to feel sick with flu-like symptoms and you're not in one of those demographics that is at an increased risk of death, call your doctor, see what they want you to do, and then follow their guidance. Now, if it's an emergency, obviously you're going into an emergency room. But for the most part, they're saying, hey, if you feel just a little crummy, make the phone call first. Talk to your actual doctor. See what they want you to do, whether or not they want you to even get tested. Because in a lot of cases, and we've certainly heard from folks locally saying, yeah, they had it, and it was a bad flu or bad flu-like symptom, mm-hmm. but they ended up getting over it within a week to 14 days, and they feel fine now. Now, that's the good part of all of this.
Right.
Problem is, of course, as you know, this spreads rather quickly, and then if it gets into a demographic of older people, people with underlying health conditions, then it's a true problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, I am being personally extra paranoid just because my wife does have a compromised immune system and she's dealing with lung cancer right now. So the last thing she needs is, you know, a virus that attacks her lungs. So we are basically on you know, total lockdown at my place, and we will be for the next couple of weeks. Certainly that's not going to be possible for every person out there. But as you say, take those precautions, maintain that social distancing, wash your hands, you know, whenever you get a chance to pass by a sink with some soap, you know, take advantage of that opportunity and do it well. And you know, again, it's going to be a the thing that drives me nuts right now, Jason, is hearing people talk about the new normal. This is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. We're not in the new normal yet, and we're not going to be there for a little while. But we will get there one day, and it will get there before we know. 100%
temporary.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. It is temporary. Do not freak out. Do not hoard items. We don't have a problem with the supply chain of food. We don't even have a supply chain issue with toilet paper. So everyone just relax. Everyone relax just a little bit.
And that's important to note. Even in Seattle, which is, you know, one of the areas of the country that has been hit the hardest right now, the supply chains are running smooth. In fact, I heard the same thing about ammunition over the weekend. That, you know, listen, this is not an issue with us not being able to get the components, us not being able to manufacture. Right now, you know, the surge is coming from demand. We can keep up and try to resupply as best we can. And again, there's no supply chain issues there either. But I think, again, we're in that moment of, because we've never dealt with anything like this before, we don't know what to expect. And I do think and hope that over the next couple of days, we can take a deep breath and we can say, okay, this is really strange. This is really weird. It's like living in a Michael Crichton novel. But we are going to be able to get through this.
Yeah. Ironically, I went to a grocery store over the weekend, and of course, there was no toilet paper or paper towels, but there was a ton of soap. So if anything, the opposite should probably be true. Go and buy your soap if you don't have any. The toilet paper, again, will be fine. And again, the good news is all this stuff gets restocked. It just gets sold very, very quickly.
Absolutely.
So the supply is there. There's tons of food in the grocery stores around this region. At certain times, obviously, if there's a swell of people coming in and purchasing it all, it's going to take a little bit of time to restock, but they're getting restocked.
All right. Jason Ranch joining us here on Bear and Arms Camp and Company. Jason, thanks for everything you're doing to keep folks informed, and I look forward to talking to you again
soon. Thank
you. I certainly do appreciate Jason joining us on the program today. And, you know, just over the next few weeks, as things are really abnormal, keep in mind and say a prayer if you're the praying kind for our first responders, for our police officers, our firefighters, our EMS, paramedics, the doctors, the nurses. And I realize this might be controversial here, even the media. Look, I know I have been disgusted with the politicizing of this crisis that we're in, particularly at the national level. But at the local level, you are going to have a lot of men and women like Jason who are there to serve their community, who are there to try to get the best information out to their community. They're going to serve as a lifeline for folks who are stuck in their home to know what's going on. And again, hopefully provide real information. So despite the animosity that a lot of us feel towards the media, there are going to be some real gems that shine over the next couple of weeks in terms of their reporting. And we need to encourage more of that. So, yes, even include the media in your thoughts and prayers over the next couple of weeks here. Now, let's get to today's armed citizen story, our recidivist report, and our good deed of the day. We'll start with our recidivist report from Kansas City, Kansas, where a second man has been charged in a shooting that left one dead, four injured. This was a shooting in Westport that was in late February. 23-year-old Ernest Jones, according to the Kansas City Star, now facing unlawful use of a weapon and armed criminal action charges for his part in that shooting in West or on Mill Street near Westport Road. Altercation that occurred earlier that evening during a birthday party celebration inside of the Throwback Nightclub. 17-year-old Devin Harris was killed in the shooting. Three other men and a woman also wounded. Prosecutors previously charged 25-year-old Devin Carter for his role in the shooting. According to the Kansas City Star, Jones was involved in a second argument that took place outside of the nightclub. A woman who appeared to be intoxicated walked across the street in front of their car. That argument happened after the driver of the car had to abruptly stop to avoid hitting the intoxicated woman. Witness later said she saw someone in a white Acura driven by Jones near a parking garage. That car followed a white Chevy Tahoe, whose occupants had also opened fire at the group. Police recovered 95 shell casings in the area of the shooting, about 40 of them matched shell casings later found in that parked SUV. As for the recidivist nature of this story, according to the Kansas City Star, back in 2017, Jones was placed on 3 years probation for unlawful use of a weapon after he pleaded guilty, according to court records. So, again, we hear politicians talk all the time about getting tough on crime, cracking down on this, right? And what actually happens when somebody is convicted of unlawful use of a weapon? By the way, that was what they pled down to. That was not the original charge. Slap on the wrist, back on the street, only to return to court and a prison cell later, when perhaps that could have been avoided had there been real consequences the first time around. Now, today's armed citizen story from Houston, Texas. Harris County Sheriff's Office says an apartment resident who is physically disabled, still able to protect themselves thanks to a firearm. A disabled woman shot an intruder Saturday afternoon, just about 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Carrington Place Apartments. When officers arrived at the scene, deputies found an 18-year-old male lying in the grass outside of building number 13. KHOU says the 18-year-old and a 17-year-old broke into a resident's home, breaking the patio door window and then gaining access inside. The 53-year-old disabled resident was home by herself. When the two teens broke the window, reached inside, unlocked the door, resident fired one shot, hitting and killing the teen who was in front. The second suspect, Aaron LaCour, as well as 18-year-old Ayanna Harrison, who police say was the driver of a nearby getaway vehicle, detained at the scene. Felony murder charges pending against both of those individuals because they committed the felony offense of burglary of a habitation, which resulted in the death of another person. The woman who was able to protect herself inside of her apartment, not facing any charges at all. Police, again, say this was a clear-cut case of self-defense. And thankfully, she was able to protect herself, because something tells me that a 53-year-old physically disabled woman probably not going to be able to put up much of a fist fight against two teenage men, or a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. All right, on to our good deed of the day from Kansas City, Missouri, where a police officer saved a boy who was choking on some carrots. See, I knew veggies were bad for you. So why you got to be careful with the carrots? Fox 4 in Kansas City says Isaac Mayo was walking home with a friend when he felt a carrot lodge in the back of his throat. He said, "I didn't know what to do." He said, "I didn't even really know what was happening." But just, again, in the right place at the right time, Officer Malcolm Whitelaw was driving down the street in his patrol car with his partner, and they saw what was going on. Officer Whitelaw says, "My partner was like, 'What are we going to do?' And I just grabbed him," he said. "Did a Heimlich real quick, started coughing up pieces of carrots." Friday afternoon, the pair reunited. Officer Whitelaw, when he saw young Isaac Mayo, first thing he said was, "How you doing? You still eating carrots?" And Isaac Mayo said, no, I'm not doing that." So, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Officer Malcolm Whitelaw there in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you, sir, for your very good deed. That is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program today. Tomorrow, we are going to try to get some information for you, legally speaking, about these emergency declarations. What can they do? What can't they do? And what are the prospects of actually challenging some of these unconstitutional provisions in court when the courts are operating on an emergency basis in many cases? Have a good rest of your Monday, as good as you can. Deep breaths, social distancing, wash your hands. We'll see you tomorrow with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Thanks again for tuning in.